Vermont Viewpoint is a public affairs program produced and funded by WDEV and the Radio Vermont Group. We welcome listener feedback. Email your comments to vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com.
Good morning. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. I'm Rick Singeri. The Fish and Wildlife Department put out a press release last week announcing that natural reproduction of Lake Champlain's lake trout has increased enough to allow a reduction in the number that are annually stocked there. Sounds like outstanding news, but whenever we're talking about lake trout, I like to get the full story from someone who has been studying their habits for decades, and that is Ellen Marsden, professor of wildlife and fisheries biology at UVM. Dr. Marsden, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Thank you, Rick. Pleasure to be here.
It's great to have you. Listeners, if you'd like to ask Professor Marsden about our lake trout, you can give us a call, 244-1777. Toll free, it's 877-291-8255. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Ellen, introduce us to the lake trout. What is this fish like?
This is a major predator, one of the top predators in the food web. It's native to the lake. And it's a generalist feeder, so it feeds vertically in the water column, and it eats basically whatever it can get its teeth into. So it helps to balance the prey populations in the lake.
When you say predator and it eats whatever it wants to, that sounds like a negative rather than a positive. But it really is important that we have this the lake trout in Lake Champlain.
Absolutely. When I say eats whatever it wants. Basically, if the smelt populations are down a little, it'll switch to ALY. If the ALY populations are down a little, it'll switch to slimy sculpin, for example. And so that helps to balance out the fluctuations that you would normally see in the forage populations. I should add that lake trout disappeared in this lake by 1990. We're not entirely sure why, because there wasn't a major commercial fishery. There wasn't a lot of angling back then. But restoration did not begin in the species until the mid-1950s, when both New York and Vermont decided that it would be very good to have this fish back, both for the fishery and for the ecosystem, and started stocking them.
So well stocked has the, or how much have we had to stock the lake through the years to kind of repopulate Lake Champlain with lake trout?
Initially, the stocking started about 160,000 fish per year, and this was back in when sustained stocking began in the 1970s. And then there was a lot of concern, of course, that at that point the sea lamprey populations were very high, and so the next stage in trying to restore this population of lake trout was to suppress the sea lamprey populations. So that program began in the 1990s with pre-assessment and then pre-control of lamprey, and once that began to take effect and lamprey populations were dropped, then, of course, the concern was maybe lake trout survival would be too high. And this speaks to management, right? You're trying to constantly balance too many predators, not enough forage, so you maybe don't want to stock as many if predator survival goes up because sea lamprey mortality of lake trout goes down, then you have to shift things again. But the states have been stocking about 84,000 lake trout per year since about late 1980s.
So really we should be teeming with lake trout and, you know, they should be repopulating, but what was going on? You know, why did we have to just keep restocking the lake every year?
And that's exactly speaking to the problem. And this is the same thing that's been happening in all of the Great Lakes. And they've been trying to restore lake trout for quite a bit longer than in Lake Champlain. You'd think it'd be easy. You put small lake trout in the lake, and they're put in it either in the first year after hatching or the second year, so they're either age zero or one, and they grow up, and they become part of the fishbowl population, and they start eating the forage. And then they show up at spawning areas, at least the two places that the states assess, and then blank, and nothing. And so when I first came here in 1996, one of the first tasks for research was to say, well, are they actually spawning at these sites? Are they spawning anyplace else? And the short answer was, well, yes. These stocked fish know how to find an area to spawn. They're depositing eggs in November, which is when they spawn. In spring, those eggs hatch. We had lots of little one-inch fry lake trout. and then we never saw them grow up. And so that's been a mystery, really, for the last 20 years of intensively studying this, is why aren't they what we call recruiting, meaning surviving past their first year of life?
Well, you had to have some theories. You've been studying this for over 20 years. So these fry, why haven't they been able to grow into lake trout?
The two obvious theories that we could come up with, I mean, basically you die because you starve or you're eaten by something else, or you die of some kind of pathogen disease. And the diseases are very well known. We've got excellent fish pathology in the lake, and the pathologists know what they're doing, and there's no obvious sign of some disease vector out there. Mm-hmm. Starvation, well, that would be plankton populations early in the life of the fishes, and there's no dramatic differences in the density of plankton, zooplankton, that is. Is it possible they were being eaten by a predator that we were unaware of, such as alewife tend to eat young lake trout fry? But, of course, there were no alewife when this restoration project started. So frankly, we really aren't sure. Probably one of the causes was this problem we've seen for a number of years of a vitamin B deficiency that was due to eating the adults eating alewife, which causes a vitamin B deficiency in the adults, so their eggs don't have vitamin B, so the fry die of that deficiency. But again, that wasn't true when we were trying to restore lake trout because we didn't have lamprey here. So it's not an easy question, Rick. It's we really didn't know.
Oh, I like to ask the really difficult lake trout questions.
As you should.
Well done. All right. Now, when did we start to see lake-hatched or naturally reproduced trout surviving in Lake Champlain?
We began in 2015 doing an intensive trawling survey. That's a net we drag along the bottom, focusing particularly on these very early life stages so we can catch the newly hatched fry with a trap on the spawning areas. But once they leave by June, they're very hard to find. They're tiny. So the trawls will catch fish between age zero and about June to age three, 3 years later. Those are the fish that are vulnerable to this particular kind of gear. We're thinking, let's at least go catch some juveniles. Prior to 2015, we'd done trawling before, sort of intermittently, and caught probably about 100 overall over several years. None of them were wild. And we know they're wild, by the way, because stocked fish are always marked before stocking with a fin clip. One of the five fins is clipped off to denote that it is a stocked fish. 2015, abruptly, we were able to find lots of juveniles, and about 23% of them were wild. So remarkable and astonishing. And that meant that the first wild fish had been actually spawned in 2012, 3 years previously to when we caught them as age three. And it's been getting better ever since then.
All of a sudden, the appearance of wild juveniles would scare most residents, but it actually got you very excited. It was a positive thing for Lake Champlain. Do we know why they were able to turn the corner and start surviving in Lake Champlain?
Again, as always, we have a number of hypotheses. Mm-hmm. Some of the obvious hypotheses are counterintuitive. So you could say, well, maybe lamprey control. Well, lamprey control really didn't take a major turn suddenly in 2015 or just prior to that. Mm-hmm. So the adults that were producing these fry doesn't appear to be related to survival from lamprey. In other lakes, we would have said, well, maybe we somehow don't have a thiamin problem anymore. We don't have an alewife problem. But in fact, we added the alewife problem, and we have natural reproduction taking off. One of the possibilities is that lake trout are a deep, cold water fish, and may, and we know in some other lakes, they spawn in deep water offshore. And in offshore, in say, Lake Michigan, we're talking like 15 miles offshore. All of the areas we know that lake trout spawn in Lake Champlain are near shore, and that's partly an artifact of where we look. I don't really like working way out in the middle of the lake in the middle of November in a gale in deep water trying to find lake trout eggs. So we haven't looked out there yet. Near shore is not necessarily the best place to spawn. Sediment from runoff and lots of productivity from phosphorus and algae, which robs oxygen from the water. Lots of problems there, and they've got worse with things like zebra mussels. So it's entirely possible that lake trout finally found offshore reefs, these stocked lake trout, started spawning out there, and that made them successful. It's a hypothesis.
Sounds like a good one. What we're seeing now, Dr. Marsden, are the numbers sustainable of these naturally reproduced lake trout?
That's the essential question, Rick, is that we hope they are, clearly. One never wants to respond too quickly to a change in the system. So one year's brood of lake trout would have been cause for celebration, but you want to be sure it continues and does sustain. At this point, we've been seeing increasing numbers of wild fish, increasing proportions of the population that's wild since 2015. It dropped a little in 2020 because we had a really rough time sampling because of COVID, and it was down a little in 2019. But in 2018, we'd gone from 23% in 2015 up to about 70% of the population of juveniles that we caught were wild, and we're now seeing wild adults. So it really does look like this is going to sustain, and that's our hope.
Why is this important to have this occur as opposed to restocking the lake each year, other than saving the cost of having to restock the lake each year?
Well, clearly, the money put into artificially doing what the lake did for us naturally doesn't make a whole lot of sense. It's also a sign that something is clearly right in the system. The inability to restore lake trout suggests that there is something out of whack that we're not quite, you know, haven't quite yet been able to identify. So it's reassuring that the system is now more self-sustaining. Probably the most critical thing is that it's the system balances itself to some extent. If the forage goes down, lake trout juveniles don't survive as well, and so they don't overstress the population. So the population should self-regulate. With stocking, we don't self-regulate. We say 85,000, and they go, 85,000, and they go. And so if the forage base is down, we're not responding to that because we can't catch up as quickly as the fish can to balance how many should be out there.
We had a caller. I couldn't stay on the line, but Ellen, they asked a couple things. First of all, wondering about the life cycle of lake trout, and then what we're seeing with lake trout in other lakes other than Lake Champlain in Vermont.
In terms of the life cycle, lake trout are, as I mentioned, they spawn in November. They're somewhat unusual among fishes because they stay as eggs for almost 6 months. They don't hatch until April or May. And then as age zero, they move off the spawning site wherever they are into deeper water. They don't mature until quite late, usually 5 to 6 years old, and then they can live to up to 50 years. In fact, we've aged fish in the lake at 35-plus years old. There are wild lake trout and self-sustaining lake trout populations in a number of the deep, cold lakes in Vermont, particularly Maidstone, Willoughby, and some of the other northern lakes.
How about in the other Great Lakes? Are you seeing something similar to Lake Champlain there?
There is a beginning throughout a number of the lakes or sites within the lakes of signs of success and still some signs, if that's the right word, of continued failure. Lake Superior always had a remnant population and has been self-sustaining for a couple of decades. Lake Huron is, parts of it are self-sustaining and have been for about a decade. Lake Ontario is still struggling, and Lake Erie, they haven't even got natural reproduction yet.
Wow. Now, the Lake Champlain Fish and Wildlife Management Cooperative is proposing to reduce lake trout stocking by 33% to maintain quality lake trout populations while avoiding stocking. Is this the right move?
This is absolutely the right move. Again, the problem is that we've now more than doubled the population of lake trout that's growing up. Well, the forage base, that is the rainbow smelt, the alewife, the sculpins, and other small fishes that these fish eat, they're not unlimited. And if you keep adding predators, at some point you stand the danger of crashing those forage populations, and then everything suffers, including Atlantic salmon and walleye and burbot, everything that eats those small fish. So it's definitely time. It's a very well-advised move. They waited to see is this going to sustain? Are we going to continue to see these wild juveniles? And the answer is yes. Time to cut back cautiously and see what happens.
Now, they also announced that current Lake Champlain stocking levels of landlocked Atlantic salmon, brown trout, steelhead, those will remain the same. So does that indicate those fish aren't reproducing in the wild?
That's correct. We're seeing some signs, and when I say we, this is the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, are seeing some signs of Atlantic salmon spawning and actually producing fry, that newly hatched stage. But they haven't yet recruited beyond that stage. They're sort of where we were 20 years ago with lake trout, that, wow, there's the small ones now. What can we do to make them survive through to the first year of life and then beyond? And then rainbow and brown are both exotics. They're not reproducing.
Hmm. And the lake trout can't tell these guys what they're doing right all of a sudden, right?
No, unfortunately, lake trout are in the lake, and Atlantic salmon spawn in streams, and so they don't talk to each other at that stage.
Bummer. You mentioned lake trout as a predator and important. But what is their role in the entire ecosystem of Lake Champlain that makes this something that you've really dedicated your studies to, and why it's really important to figure this out and to get it right?
Part of it is that they do spend their entire life, unlike salmon, they spend their entire lives in the lake. So changes in the lake trout are vulnerable to. If the prey base changes, lake trout will suffer. If we add something like alewife, as I mentioned, lake trout in the Great Lakes suffered accordingly. So they're a really good ecosystem indicator and have been used as such for a long time. If you can get a healthy population of lake trout surviving and self-sustaining after the damage we've done to the system and to overfishing in the Great Lakes, that's a sign that we're starting to turn a corner and have a more healthy ecosystem.
How heavily are these lake trout fished in Lake Champlain now?
To be perfectly honest, they're not the most popular fish, simply because they don't fight well. If somebody wants a really exciting catch, they're going to go after Atlantic salmon, which are also, and many would say, a much more beautiful fish. I might argue with that from my favorite standpoint of lake trout. But lake trout are a very reliable catch, and so they might not quite take the numbers that Atlantic salmon do in terms of which fish are being targeted. But, of course, they do get substantially larger than Atlantic salmon. So we can hope for these 30, 40-year-old fish eventually that are 10, 15 pounds and more.
Why aren't we just teeming with lake trout? If we're putting 85,000 in each year, they can last till they're 50 years old. Why haven't we seen such incredible numbers of them, other than the fact that they're not reproducing in the wild until just recently? Why don't we just have too many in the lake with the numbers that we've restocked year in and year out?
That's a great question. And partly, we're simply, it's a big lake, and so 85,000 sounds like a lot, but there will be natural mortality of those fish. The random fish are going to die from whatever causes kill any organism throughout its life. And so although they can live to 30 or 40 years, and we're seeing a few fish in that 30-plus age classes, in fact, there's a steady loss of fish over those ages. So 84,000 stocked 1 year, 5 years later, there's less than half of those still left over. And, of course, we've not only got anglers pulling them out of the lake, but we've also got sea lamprey still doing quite a lot of damage.
The sea lamprey.
Sea lamprey.
Yeah. How do lake trout differ from the trout that populate our rivers and streams here in Vermont?
The trout in rivers and streams are they're Atlantic salmon, which technically is a trout, but that's a taxonomic argument, and rainbow trout. Those are fishes that either live their entire life in running water, or they live part of their life in streams and part of their life in lakes, as do Atlantic salmon, whereas lake trout never enter flowing water. It's very rare to have a population, there's one up in Lake Superior, that does actually spawn in streams, but that's unusual.
Other than it's in their name, lake trout, why don't they head into streams and rivers? Why is that running water something that they're just not attracted to or they're repelled by?
It's simply a completely different strategy, sort of evolutionary strategy. The fish like Atlantic salmon that enter freshwater streams are actually evolved to be in the ocean. And they're normally a saltwater fish that comes into streams to spawn. And this gets into basic fish biology or basic organismal biology. A fish wants to live its adult life where it can feed the best because it wants to grow up, but it wants to put its offspring in a place where they'll be most safe. And streams are, relatively speaking, a nice safe place to be. There aren't huge great predators in small streams, and the eggs can get hidden in the gravel when the adults spawn and build a nest. A lake trout has a different strategy. It spends its entire life feeding in a lake where there's lots of food, but it hides its fry, hides its eggs down in rocks on spawning sites where they trickle down into crevices and they're hidden that way. And when they hatch, they've got lots of plankton available to them in the spring.
So the great mystery remains. Before we were wondering why the fry didn't survive. Now they're surviving. We're wondering why they survive. So, what are you doing? Where's your research going or leading to find that answer?
One of the foci of the research is this question of where are they coming from? And this takes two approaches. That is to say, where were they spawned? Is it possible we've seen a shift in the spawning sites from these lake, by these lake trout? So I have one graduate student who's tagging these fish with acoustic tags that basically ping and tell the location of where fish are. About every 2 minutes, the ping is picked up by receivers. So part of what we're doing is focusing on these potential offshore spawning sites and asking the fish, is that where you're going in November? If we see clusters of them, that might indicate they're spawning offshore. And then we've also got a genetic study that's looking at, for one thing, the particular stocking strategies. We've never really asked which lake trout stocked where survive the best. And so that will tell us, is there a change in which adults have been surviving that might contribute to better spawning success?
Well, I'm really excited that you convinced the lake trout to spawn in the wild, and somehow their fry are surviving. I can't wait to hear when we have the next discovery. Ellen Marsden is a professor of wildlife and fisheries biology at UVM. She studies restoration and ecology of Great Lakes fish, primarily lake trout. Dr. Marsden, always interesting and informative speaking with you. Thanks so much.
Pleasure to talk to you, Rick. Thank you.
All right, take care. Let's pop out for a CBS News update, and then we're going to return to speak with VT Digger editor Ann Galloway about the latest EB5 news. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Spring is springing. There's still plenty of snowpack, so good reason to visit the Mad River Valley. While you're here, make a stop at the almost world-famous Warren's Store. Newly renovated, delicious deli offerings and world-class bakery. Online ordering now available. You must be ready to ditch those COVID sweatpants. We've got some cute, comfy, casual clothing upstairs at the Warren Store from some of your favorite brands. Free People, Z Supply, and Tribal, to name a few. Fall winter clothing is still on sale, so head on down to Warren Village. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. WarrenStore.com.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Singeri. When you think of EB5, you think of VTDigger.org, founder and editor Ann Galloway. No, not because she was tied up in it, more because she untied what was happening with the program. Seemed like a bit of an odd government program to begin with, attracting foreign investors with the promise of getting a green card and becoming lawful permanent residents in the U.S. It was tied to revitalization in Newport, Jay, and Burke. And then it wasn't. Ann Galloway joins us now to bring us up to date on what's happening with the EB5 situation in Vermont. Ann, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Hi, Rick. Thank you so much for having me on.
Oh, totally. Listeners, if you've got a question or comment about the EB5 program in Vermont, give us a call, 244-1777, 877-291-8255. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. And let's take a look at what the EB5 program was hoping to create in the Northeast Kingdom.
Yes, originally there were more than a dozen projects proposed, and that included not only the 8 separate developments at Jay Peak, and the renovations and expansion of Burke Mountain, but also an office building in Newport, at one point a window manufacturer in the kingdom, an airport project, and also ANC Bio, which was a proposed biomedical facility in Newport. So it was designed to create 10,000 jobs, and they were looking for many more investors than they actually brought in. They brought in 851 foreign investors who put up about $425 million plus administrative fees. So it was, you know, north of $450 million. In a pretty short period of time, it was from 2006 to 2016, so about a 10-year period.
Were there any other big EB-5 projects proposed anywhere else in the state at the time?
Yes, none of them were at that scale. There were projects that were in motion at Sugarbush and at Mount Snow. There was a water purification company in the Upper Valley, and then Von Trapp's Brewery in Stowe, and several others I'm forgetting.
That's all right.
Yeah.
And did any of these come to fruition because of the EB-5 program?
Yes, as a matter of fact, the Sugarbush project was very successful, and Wynn Smith, the previous owner, committed to paying the investors back, and I believe he did so already. In the case of the Von Trapp Brewery, it's an unknown. It's unclear whether the investors have been repaid or not because the state has locked down all information on EB-5 projects. There was another project in Stowe at the Stowe Airport that was killed by the state, in part because Russell Barr, the owner of the airport, started raising questions, and then he in turn became the attorney for investors who wanted to get to the bottom of the state's involvement.
Now, I know one thing was that a certain number of jobs had to be created, but was repayment also part of the deal when someone invested in the EB-5? They were, to get a green card, but were they expecting to be repaid for the investment they made?
Yes, and this can be kind of confusing, but yes, there was no guarantee that the investors would get their money back, but there was an expectation that they would, based on materials that both J-Peak and the state published. You know, the developers, the J-Peak projects, were soliciting investors around the world, and they had brochures and meetings with politicians and so on, in which they promised the investors that they would get their money back with a return in addition to the green cards. And that's part of the reason why people were anxious to invest in Vermont, because they saw that the state of Vermont was so closely involved, and people assumed, based on what state officials said, that their money would be protected and that the program was legit. And it turned out that that was not the case.
Well, you mentioned $425 million being raised very quickly. Vermont officials, including many of our politicians, got behind this effort to attract. So who were some of the people who were leading the way and trying to attract foreign investment into these programs?
Yes, so there were a handful of people at the Commerce Agency who are working hand in glove with individuals at J-Peak Resort who are also soliciting investors. So you had on the J-Peak side of the equation, you had Douglas Hume, who had his own company called Rapid Visas. He was going around the world and soliciting investors, largely from Europe. And then you had a number of attorneys who were actively working on behalf of Jay Peake and actually received kickbacks in exchange for representing investors who came into the program. There were dozens of those lawyers who were involved. And then Bill Stanger himself went out and talked to people. Ariel Quiros, who allegedly stole tens of millions of dollars, actually never did any soliciting himself. He's accused of misusing the money, but he wasn't out front. Bill Stanger was really the front man. Then you had the characters at the state agency who included people like James Candido, who was the original regional center director. The state had its own regional center, which was kind of unusual. We were one of two or three around the country, and certainly the oldest state-run Vermont regional, regional center. And that meant that the regional center was responsible for vetting the offering documents and monitoring and administering the program, in addition to soliciting investors overseas. So in addition to James Candido, you had Brent Raymond, who is also a director of the regional center, and former agency heads, including Kevin Dorn and Lawrence Miller and Pat Moulton, Joan Goldstein, Eugene Fulham. There were a string of Commerce Agency secretaries, especially at the end. They just kept kind of flipping over. I think Lucy LaRiche was agency director at one point, Commerce Secretary at one point. So they had a hard time hanging on to people. Folks were just sort of passing the hot potato, at the end.
Well, in 2014, you, VT Digger, start to look at some complaints that were being filed, and kind of like a loose thread in a sweater, you pulled at it, it started to unravel. First of all, what were the complaints you were hearing?
Well, I had heard from investors who said that their property, the way their investment was set up, they were supposed to have owned the Tram House, which is one of the hotels on the Jay Peake Resort property. And at one point in August of 2013, Ariel Quiros and Bill Stanger seized ownership of the Tram House and essentially wrested the property away from the investors. And so they complained that not only did they lose their ownership stake, but they also didn't get any money for it. The investors were not paid anything in the beginning, and they set a balloon payment schedule in which the investors would be paid over a 10-year period, essentially. And they were outraged this happened. There were 32 of them, and about 20 of them were willing to talk with me as part of this group, and they complained that the state wasn't willing to do anything to help them. The state effectively basically sent them back to Jay Peake and said, this is a private business. We don't have anything to say here. You're going to have to take up your complaint with Bill Stanger. And the investors tried to do that, and they failed to make any progress. And that's when they started reaching out to me.
And let's go to Duxbury. Dee is calling. Morning, Dee.
Hi, good morning. I wanted to know, I wanted to know if you know what's going to happen with the bombed out downtown Newport.
All right. That pit remains there in Newport City. What are the plans, or are there plans for anything there?
I'm not aware of any concrete plans for filling in that area, which is really unfortunate. I know that there's been a lot of talk, but I haven't heard lately whether the property has been sold or anyone has been interested in developing it. It was that section of the Main Street was torn down in March of 2015, so it's been a long time now.
And what part of the project was that supposed to be in?
Yes, that was supposed to be the Renaissance office building.
Hmm. All right, let's take another call. We've got Bill joining us from Moortown. Morning, Bill.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. And I got a couple of questions, and maybe I misinterpreted what you said about 10 minutes ago there. But I understood you to say that the reason they went overseas to get help for this EB-5, the state wouldn't help them develop J-Peak like they wanted to.
All right, and Bill, what's the other question? Why don't you ask both of them right off the bat?
Okay, the other one, make it short and sweet here.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure that we had two dignitaries from the state of Vermont. The governor and another senior senator went. So anyway, thank you for taking my call.
All right, thanks, Bill. All right, so Ann, first question, was the reason for seeking foreign investment because the state wasn't willing to invest or help in any way? The second were, I think, Governor Shumlin and Patrick Leahy are who he's referring to, involved in some way in attracting foreign investors for the EB-5 program.
Yes, thank you so much, Bill, for the questions. First of all, the period in which Bill Stenger and Ariel Kiro sought to expand J-Peak was just about the period when the Great Recession started. And so it was actually quite difficult at that time to get financing for the renovations and new developments that Bill and Ariel had planned. They invested $250 million in J-Peak alone during a pretty short period of time from between 2007 or 8 until about 2012. So in that four-year period, they built four major developments on the site, and then after that, they finished Stateside, which was a third hotel on the property. There are many condos on the site and so on, and state government often provides incentives for companies, but rarely provides that kind of financing for developments of this sort. And so that's why they went overseas to solicit interest from investors in the EB-5 program to help support their plans. As for the state officials who were involved in talking with foreign investors, yes, you're right. Governor Peter Shumlin was directly involved in making asks to investors in China and Vietnam. He also was part of an investor meeting in Miami. Senator Patrick Leahy also traveled overseas with Representative Peter Welch. They went to Shanghai together one year and talked to investors there. The senator was also involved in events at J-Peak for investors, and was instrumental in creating the EB-5 program to start with, and was great friends with Bill Stenger before it was discovered that he was involved in the scandal. So the senator has long been an advocate of this kind of investment across the country and in Vermont.
I know Senator Leahy making some moves to adjust the EB-5 program by the federal government. What are the moves, the changes that have been made to this program since this what happened here came to light several years ago?
Well, to my knowledge, they have not been able to get congressional support for the reforms that Patrick Leahy wanted to push through, which had to do with more government oversight of programs like the one here in Vermont. And to my knowledge, they have not been able to make that happen. Perhaps that will be something that will, I know it's on his priority list. I saw a press release about another effort with Chuck Grassley to reform the program that just came out a few weeks ago. But to my knowledge, nothing has actually come to fruition. So the program has continued to be kind of the Wild West of the SEC. I mean, there have been scandals all over the country. This one at JPEEK, though, is the largest one that has been that has been exposed.
I know investors are a little disappointed right now with the assistance that they're getting from the Vermont Attorney General's office. They say they're slowing the process. What's going on there, Ann?
Yeah, you know, I think one of the things I've neglected to mention previously is that about half of the investors don't have their green cards yet, and some of them have been threatened with being deported because they don't have proper visas as a result of the fraud. Really, through no fault of their own, they're not able to retain their ability to stay in this country. So it's pretty dire for many of them. And they have, since 2017, attempted to sue the state over negligence charges. And that case has slowly kind of wended its way through the courts and was dismissed initially in Lamoille County. And then their case went to the Supreme Court. The High Court decided to support their negligence claim against the state in that they said they ought to be given a chance to take the case to trial. And so that's what Russell Barr, the attorney for the investors, is attempting to do. And the difficulty has been that the AG's office, which is defending state officials, has really slow-walked this process. They required that the Supreme Court decision be reevaluated, reassessed. That took months. Then that was ultimately took a year. And then when Barr Law Group attempted to get a discovery back in November, the AG's office threw up all kinds of hurdles and continues to block depositions and potentially records. I mean, they've made it very clear that they're going to require the investors to pay for records and to pay for redactions to those records. And they're being required to wait for the records before they can get the depositions. And that's not typically how it works. Typically, the plaintiffs can request depositions prior to a records request if they feel they have grounds to do so, and the state is blocking that in a major way. And so the story I had about 10 days ago, a week ago, this is a week ago now, basically outlined all of that and showed how deeply the state was in bed with Stenger and Kyros and how the information about the activities has been blocked now for years. I'm involved in a third lawsuit against the state for records, and that's also been a difficult case.
Ann Galloway is the founder and editor of VTDigger.org and has been covering the state's EB-5 scandal since before anyone knew it was a problem. Ann, thanks so much for the update.
Oh, thank you, Rick. It was a pleasure to be on the show with you. Thank you very much.
Sure. Great to have you. We're going to break now for CBS News, and then we'll be back to talk about summer camps and other kids' stuff. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Spring is springing. There's still plenty of snowpack, so good reason to visit the Mad River Valley. While you're here, make a stop at the almost world-famous Warren's Store. Newly renovated, delicious deli offerings and world-class bakery. Online ordering now available. You must be ready to ditch those COVID sweatpants. We've got some cute, comfy, casual clothing upstairs at the Warren Store from some of your favorite brands. Free People, Z-Supply, and Tribal, to name a few. Fall winter clothing is still on sale, so head on down to Warren Village. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. WarrenStore.com.
This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. Let's forget about the wild card that is the COVID variant for a moment. There is a decent chance that this summer our world will return to normal, or at least semi-normal, which would be pretty good considering. And that means kids can have a summer like kids deserve, relaxing, getting outside, going to camp, enjoying being kids. Kids Vermont, which for the past 15 years has helped make parenting easier and family life more fun, is doing that with a summer camp fair. And here to tell us about that and to let us know about the other helpful stories they have for parents are Allison Novak and Corey Grenier. Allison is the managing editor of Kids Vermont. Welcome back, Allison.
Thanks very much.
And Corey is events and marketing manager. And Corey, it's great to have you here as well.
Thank you so much for having us this morning.
Oh, you're welcome. Now, listeners, if you've got questions about camps or the camp fair, you can give us a call, 244-1777, 877-291-8255. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Allison, let's first talk about Kids Vermont. What will parents find each month in Kids Vermont and at your website?
So every month we have a collection of different articles by contributors. So topics include everything from how to have a low-waste lifestyle with kids to music to art. We also this month have a really great feature on how families have experienced different rites of passage during this year of the pandemic. So then there's also, you know, in normal times we've had a very robust events calendar, and now we're starting back up with a calendar section where we have 10 events every month kind of that might be of interest to families. So it's kind of a mix of articles and then also things to do with kids.
Love to hear that the events calendar is starting to get filled up again. That's a great sign. Corey, yeah. Let's talk about this summer camps fair. What will parents find there?
So in a normal year, the Kids Vermont Camp and School Fair is usually held at the Hilton in downtown Burlington, and we have around 60 summer camps and schools, and families would come and get the opportunity to talk with everyone all under one roof to kind of figure out what their options are for summer for their family. This year, we had to pivot our plans like so many others with everything. So we decided to have a virtual version of the camp fair this year. This is the one that's coming up on April 10th is the second one we've done this year. We had one back in February. We had 14 camps in the February edition, and it was very popular, so we decided to have a second round on Saturday, April 10th. And on that Saturday, we have so far 5 camps in a few schools who all will have 30 minutes to discuss what they have to offer for camps and for summer camps and options for kids. And parents have the opportunity to ask questions and get all their questions answered safely from home.
Excellent. And is that how the one in February was handled as well, that each camp did 30 minutes?
Yep. So we have 30-minute slots where the camps will talk about for about 20 minutes, talking about what camp looks like in a normal year, how camp is going to look this year, mm-hmm. protocols that they're, safety protocols that they're taking to ensure the safety of all campers that are involved. And then obviously there's time for questions. And we have been really pleased with this new format. I don't have children myself, but we've heard that it's nice to be able to watch from home. And we also stream the Zooms. We do it on Zoom. We stream it to the our Facebook page as well. So if people can't see it right there and then, they can still access the information. And all of the recordings from the February camp fair is up on the Kids Vermont website. So if you didn't miss that, you can go over kidsvermont.com to check out the exhibitors from the past and then save the date for the one that is coming up on April 10th.
Nice. Now, Allison, from what you've heard, all things being equal, will camps be opening up for kids this summer?
Yes. I think that the majority of camps that have run in the past are going to be running this summer, obviously with different protocols in place for COVID, since obviously kids won't be vaccinated over the summer. Mm-hmm. Last summer, you know, I think it was a pretty slim pickings in terms of camps. And I think parents were a little more nervous maybe to send their kids to camp last summer. But, you know, kids have been going to school pretty much all year. And I think parents are the comfort level now in terms of sending their kids to camp and also just giving their kids kind of that outdoor experience. And, you know, the ability to engage and interact with other kids is something that, you know, I think parents are kind of ready to do this summer.
Mm-hmm. And you both have mentioned protocols, Allison. So what are protocols that camps are taking, you know, in this time of pandemic?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think Corey has, you know, some more specific information as to kind of like the individual camps. But I know, mm-hmm. obviously, masking, I think smaller group size. Corey, maybe you could speak to a little as to what the camps who were in the February fair said about their protocols.
Yeah, so a lot of, obviously all the states, all of the camps are following, you know, what the current guidelines are for the state. A lot of the camps are staggering arrival times for campers to make sure they're limiting the amount of people that come all at once. They're also accepting less students, less campers than they would in a typical year, which also means that a lot of summer camps are filling up. Because also last year, a lot of people decided not to go or couldn't go last year. So people who were supposed to go last year were already reserved for this year. Mm-hmm. So limiting the amount of campers that can come, obviously masking, staggering arrival times, doing as much stuff outside as possible. One of the camps was mentioning that they got a big tent outside that they normally might not have, so for more outside opportunities, and then just, you know, masking, distance, all the things that everyone is, you must do to be safe.
Corey, you mentioned camps that are filling up. I, like you, do not have children, so I'm not sure when, you know, you need to register for camps. But I kind of get from friends who do have children that it really, like you had the earlier one in February, if you're looking at things on April 10th, you probably want to make a decision fairly soon as to what camps your children want to go to.
Yeah, so we typically have the normal big camp, in-person camp fair in February, because that is around the time where people start doing their research and making plans for the summer. I had heard that a few of the camps that we had at our last one are full, but the camps that we have coming up in April do have availability, and even if, you know, there might not be opportunities this summer, but it's still a great way to find out, learn a little bit more about the cool opportunities that we have here in Vermont. So for maybe, if not this summer, maybe next summer.
Gotcha. And hopefully by then, this world will be as normal as it can get again. And, you know, kids going to camp will be just another regular thing that happens again. Allison, what have you been learning about how important it is for kids to have that social interaction that's been lacking for them during this pandemic?
I mean, I think it's huge. I do have kids. I have a 13-year-old and an 11-year-old, and my 13-year-old, who's only in school right now 2 days a week, she just gets so excited on the days she's able to go to school and interact with her peers. And, you know, it's a totally different thing than being on Zoom meetings all day. I mean, she's engaged, you know, at home virtually, but actually getting to be in person with other kids is just such a huge, you know, boost to her mood. And I think in the summer, too, it's like kids just being able to be outside, interacting and playing with other kids is so important, especially, you know, after this year where there was a lot of kind of virtual learning, a lot of hybrid learning, and just to have that sense of normalcy of, you know, being around kids your age, I think is really, really critical for kids.
Well, it's really great to hear that even though she only goes to school 2 days a week, she, you said, gets really excited to go to school. That's got to be kind of a wonderful thing for a parent to experience.
It is. It is. Yeah. And I mean, you know, my husband's a teacher. Teachers are just working so hard this year to, you know, try to make things as normal and fun and engaging as possible for kids. It's been a rough year. So,
Corey, give us some examples of the variety of camps that are available for kids this summer.
So upcoming on the virtual camp fair we have on Saturday, April 10th, we have Let Go Your Mind Summer STEM Camp. Summer, their camp, your students will be able to use Legos in areas of simple machinery and robotics to learn about science, technology, engineering, and math. Camp Edge has weekly camps. Each week has different themes. 1 week is going to be outer space themed. 1 week it's all about nature. The Common Ground Center actually has a family camp. Mm. So for all you parents out there who are wishing that you could go to summer camps again, you can. You can go with your kids. And get in on the action. They also have a bunch of different types of camps, but the family camp I thought was pretty unique. The American Precision Museum also offers day camp for children 12, for children ages 9 to 12. Campers will work on multiple projects daily linked to concepts they see in the museum, such as simple machines, measurement, and energy transfer. And the Lake Champlain Waldorf School just joined in on the action for Saturday, April 10th. They also have summer camps throughout the summer with different themes each week. But at the last one, we had, back in February, we had the Community Sailing Center. We had the Chittenden County Humane Society. Mm. We had the Davis Studio, Bolton Valley. So there's really, you know, whether your child is interested in arts or mountain biking or animals or, you know, or building Legos to learn how to build robots. There really is something for everyone locally, and there are a few out-of-state camps that are accepting Vermonters with, obviously, they have all the proper protocols in place. But and also, most camps do offer scholarship opportunities for people that you just can reach out to them directly to inquire.
I was intrigued when you said the American Precision Museum. I have not been, so I had to find out where that is, and that is in Windsor, Vermont. So next time I get down that way, a place I'd like to check out. Corey, did you attend camps as a kid?
I didn't. So that's why I am personally, I feel like as someone who has been planning the camp fair and learning about all these cool camps, I am slightly jealous that I didn't go to camp as a child. So that's why this family camp at Common Ground Center, maybe that's my chance.
So, you're going to grab a family and go, aren't you?
Yeah, exactly.
Allison, how about you? Were you a summer camper?
You know, I did. I attended a couple different summer camps when I was elementary age that were kind of more general, you know, like you said, summer camps where you did, you know, outdoor activities and games and swimming and things like that. And I've got to say, camps have really come a long way since I was a kid. My kids have done actually quite a few of the camps that have been at our camp fair. So my son did the Let Go Your Mind Lego camp a couple years ago, which he, you know, did some stop motion animation videos using Legos and had a really amazing time with a couple of friends who also joined in with him. My daughter has done a bunch of Davis Studio camps. So she did this amazing sewing camp where she sewed her own outfit, and they had a fashion show at the end that was just amazing and kind of sparked her interest in sewing. So I feel like what's changed from when I was a kid and most parents were kids is that just there's so many more specialized camps that really kind of, you know, cater to kids' interests. And so you can think about, you know, what does my child really want to learn this summer? And probably there's a camp that fits whatever they want to learn.
I was more like Corey. I never went to camp, although we had a pretty robust neighborhood where the kids and, you know, moms were and dads were still around. So we played all the time outside all summer long. But I was kind of jealous of my cousins from New Jersey who used to come up to Vermont for summer camp. And they still have great memories of those times here in Vermont. Allison, now I did read in Kids Vermont a story that you wrote about your family playing Monopoly during dinner. So how'd that all start?
So that was my editor's note, and essentially I was just trying to, you know, get the point across that at this point in the pandemic, you know, sometimes days can feel like Groundhog's Day. You know, it's like you wake up, you do the same thing every day. And so just trying to figure out as a family ways to change things up a bit and make things feel a little more novel or special. And so one of the things we started doing was just instead of just eating and asking each other about our days, which, you know, truthfully, we're not that exciting often, we got out the Monopoly board and would play while we ate. And it was just a different way to interact and just kind of made dinner time a little more fun and took a little pressure off to have to just come up with interesting things to say about our day when maybe there wasn't that many interesting things to say. So I think, you know, it does feel like there's a little bit of a light at the end of the tunnel now, but I do think at this point, you know, it's been over a year and families are, it's been tough on families. And so just finding different ways to kind of make things feel special and kind of spice things and change things up a bit is pretty important.
Well, I'm wondering with Monopoly, two things: if you have a winning strategy, and how you teach kids to win or lose gracefully, which is not an easy thing.
It isn't an easy thing. No, I mean, I would not buy all the properties I would land on, but now essentially, whenever we land on properties, we just buy them.
That's right.
Who can get the as many hotels? I mean, Boardwalk obviously is a pretty pretty hot property, so I feel like it turns out in our family whoever ends up buying Boardwalk is usually the person who wins the game.
Oh, interesting.
But these games, you know, stretch out for many days.
Yeah.
Monopoly is not a short game.
No, it isn't. Yeah, I was wondering how you would get it done through one dinner, but I can see where that would go on. Corey, you schedule events as well as, you know, I think collect events that are scheduled elsewhere. But during this pandemic, have you had to kind of alter what you schedule for Kids Vermont?
So I'm the marketing events director for Kids Vermont and 7 Days.
Oh, boy.
So things like Vermont Restaurant Week and the Vermont Tech Jam, all of our singles parties, first-time home buying seminars. For Kids Vermont, we have every year specifically we have the Kids Vermont Spectacular, which is a talent show at Higher Ground. And this year we usually have live auditions, and this year we had kids submit audition videos, and we received over 50 audition videos, which was a great response. And then we partnered with WCIX, actually, and they aired. We narrowed down the 50 to the top 20. We had the Kids Vermont staff narrowed it down using our judging criteria, and we aired the top 20 acts on TV, which was made me cry every day when I watched it, because it was so nice to, especially for kids who haven't, you know, they haven't had their social interactions. If they do love to perform, they haven't been able to perform. They haven't been able to go to chorus or band or show or dance or show off their talent. So it was really special to be able to give those kids the opportunity to show off their skills to a really big audience.
That's really
that
neat.
That was just one of, so that was this, the theme of this year is figuring out we can't do our events how we normally do them. So how can we make them happen safely in virtually. So that has been, it has been the struggle, and but also a nice challenge this past year.
Absolutely. Allison, we only have a couple more minutes, but what are some articles or features that we're going to be reading about in the next issue of Kids Vermont?
So I'm always on the lookout for kind of new contributors, and so I found we have a new contributor starting in April. Her name's Maria Monroe, and she writes all about thrift store shopping.
Mm.
And so she has a new column about she just had a baby 5 months ago, and it's all about kind of why thrifting is a good strategy both for the environment, but also kind of on your wall, good on your wallet when you have a baby. And so that's a new feature this month. We also have a really interesting, we have a personal essay every issue. And so the personal essay this month was written by a childcare provider, a home childcare provider, just about what this year has been like for her. And it's kind of, she writes it kind of as like a day in the life of a childcare provider. And it's kind of comical because, you know, childcare providers are pretty busy and have to multitask a lot. So that piece is a great piece. Let's see. We also have a piece by Keegan Alba, who's her dad contributor. He writes a pop culture column, and essentially it's about his anxiety over reentering social, kind of like reentering the pandemic reentry, I guess, social anxiety. And kind of how he's preparing for that, how he's excited but also kind of nervous to enter back into, you know, social interaction, which I think a lot of people can relate to.
Oh, totally. I want to remind people that the fair, summer camp fair, is April 10th. And Allison, tell people where they go to be part of it.
So if you go to kidsvt.com, there'll be a link that you can use to sign up. So, Corey, you could say a little more about that as well.
Yeah, so if you go to kidsvt.com/fair, that will bring you directly to the landing page. And the landing page has the full schedule of all of the camps that are coming, going to be talking more about what they have to offer, and you can register. All of the presentations will be on Zoom, but they'll also be streamed to our Facebook page, so you can watch on Zoom or on Facebook. And then there are also recordings on that page from the last fair that we had in February if you wanted to watch and learn more about those other camps.
All right. Got to say goodbye. Thank you both.
And
this is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Spring is springing. There's still plenty of snowpack, so good reason to visit the Mad River Valley. While you're here, make a stop at the almost world-famous Warren's Store. Newly renovated, delicious deli offerings and world-class bakery. Online ordering now available. You must be ready to ditch those COVID sweatpants. We've got some cute, comfy, casual clothing upstairs at the Warren's Store from some of your favorite brands. Free People, Z Supply, and Tribal, to name a few. Fall winter clothing is still on sale, so head on down to Warren Village. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. WarrensStore.com.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Singeri. When I was speaking with Allison and Corey of Kids Vermont, I mentioned that there are still those old school kind of camps that so many of us grew up with, where you really did get to commune with nature and get a better understanding for the natural world around us. One such camp is put on by Vermont's Fish and Wildlife Department, and it's for boys and girls. It's the Green Mountain Conservation Camps. Here to tell us about them is Hannah Phelps, the Green Mountain Conservation Camps coordinator. Hannah, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Hi, Rick. How you doing?
I'm great. How about you?
Good, thanks.
It's good to have you. Now, listeners, if you've got questions about the camp or know someone, maybe you, who has attended this camp, you can give us a call at 244-1777 or toll-free 877-291-8255. And you can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. What are the Green Mountain Conservation Camps, Hannah?
Well, the Green Mountain Conservation Camps, like you said, it's a program run by the Vermont Fish and Wildlife Department. We offer one-week sessions for both boys and girls, but we separate our sessions by gender. So 1 week we may have a boys' week going on at one camp and a girls' week at another, and vice versa. We have two locations in Vermont, one on Lake Bomazine in Castleton, and then one up on Buck Lake in Woodbury, just to try to increase our accessibility to Vermonters. We run the exact same program at both camps, but we are an outdoor education program, so we're getting kids outside, engaging with nature, teaching biology and ecology. And in addition to that, we are a hunter education safety program, so we offer the campers the opportunity during their basic week to get their firearms and their bow hunting certifications at the end of the week. So pretty cool. We do it all.
How long have they been going on, these camps?
We were founded in 1966. So we've been doing it for a little more than 50 years now.
Oh, that's incredible. And how many kids attend each year?
Typically, we have about 1,000 kids that come through both locations combined. This year, it'll be about half of that.
Gotcha. COVID. But that's a great amount of kids who get this. And are they sleepover or day camps?
Yep, they're sleepover for the week. So campers, it's unlike other summer camps where campers might have the option to stay for a week or two or eight. We are just 1 week, but they spend the night for that week. So it's a week at a time overnight.
All right. You touched on a little bit of this, but tell us about the activities that the campers will participate in.
Yeah, we have, like I said, a lot of outdoor education. So we have department staff, so foresters, well, they're from our sister department, Parks and Rec, but biologists, wardens come in to help the campers learn about biology, ecology. We take them on a wetland study, and they get to sort of play in the mud and learn about the creatures that live there. We do a forestry unit and have the foresters come in and talk about forest health and measuring trees and all kinds of stuff like that. We take them canoeing and fishing and hiking. We do an overnight camp trip on Thursday nights. We take them out into the woods, and the kids get to cook dinner over the fire and build shelters and sleep out there with the staff, which is awesome. And then in addition to that, like I said, we're the hunter education program. So they handle 22 rifles and 20-gauge shotguns. They learn how to do that safely, and they're given the chance to shoot them during the week. They also learn intensively about firearm hunting and bow hunting. So we have specific classes just to cover those topics and make sure that everyone is getting the material they need to hopefully pass the written test on Friday.
Oh, there's a written test at the for the hunting safety.
For the hunter safety.
All right, good. That makes sense to me. I thought just for camping, and that would be.
Oh no.
All right, good. And Hannah, I think you had this last summer, so the changes are probably in place from last year. But because of the pandemic, how have the camps changed? What have you had to do to alter it and set protocols?
Absolutely. So this year, I touched on this briefly. We are cutting our capacity by about 50%. That is going to allow us to keep camp as much as possible the same. So by cutting down the camper capacity, we can keep our behavior similar and not have to worry so much about adapting our behaviors. So hopefully it won't look too different. But we, like I said, fewer campers. We also this year have to restrict it to just Vermont residents. So we aren't allowing out-of-state campers to come in this year. But to make up for that, next year we are going to have age exceptions to allow as many kids to come back who missed out on this year or last year. And then we are going to require masks while at camp as of right now. But in general, we're going to offer all the same activities. We're going to, you know, give kids all the same opportunities. So we're looking at a really good summer this year.
What ages are these camps for?
We have two levels of camp within our program. So our basic week is, if you've never been to camp before, you're coming for the first time, 12 to 14 years old can come to our basic week. And then the second time you come back to camp, which will be at least a year after your first time, we have an advanced session. So it's a little more flexible. There's some choices that the campers have. And during that week, you can attend that week until you're 16 years old.
Oh, nice. And kids with what kinds of interests will really enjoy these camps, Hannah?
Honestly, kids with interests across the board find things they love about this camp. The most important is they like being outside. And I think that's really important, especially with COVID, especially in today's day and age, just getting kids outside, unplugged, and engaged in the environment around them.
Why this year, more than most, do you think kids need to get out to a camp like this?
Yeah, COVID. with all the remote learning that's been happening, I think it's more important than ever to actually gather in person safely, but really engage with their peers. You know, a lot of kids across Vermont have been seeing their teachers and their classmates, but through a screen and missing out on that person-to-person interaction. Our camp does not allow kids to bring cell phones or computers with them, so it will be all immersive peer-to-peer interaction, really making those genuine connections with each other and you know, focusing on actually, you know, connecting in person again after a virtual year.
I think 99% of the parents listening, when you said no cell phones, no computers, just all leapt with joy and were nodding and thinking, yeah, boy, that's a great camp right there. I know so much of it is, you know, getting in touch with the natural world and experiencing that. But I think I read something where, you know, even though there's such an emphasis on STEM, and there really are like STEM elements in these camps.
Yes, absolutely. So we have a lot of science in our camps in terms of natural sciences, natural history, biology, ecology. But you can't really do science without doing the rest of STEM as well. So, you know, engineering, we talk about physics in terms of using a bow and how the energy is passed from the bow to the arrow to make it go down the range, that sort of stuff. Math, you know, math is everywhere in life. Mm-hmm. We have all kinds of stuff, whether we're measuring water quality or calculating how many deer are in a population after changing different variables. You know, math is everywhere. And technology, again, we focus on more of the primitive side of technology in terms of, you know, bows and firearms and all that kinds of stuff. But we have it all. We have it that available, mostly through a natural science lens. But that's what got me involved. Camp is what got me involved in STEM to begin with. And I graduated with a science degree. So it's everywhere, and we definitely offer that opportunity.
What was camp like when you attended?
You know, very similar to it is now. It hasn't changed that much. The changes have all been for the better that have happened. But I attended my basic week in 2009, and I got pretty much the same experience that kids will be getting these days, you know, going out, hiking, canoeing, fishing, and spending a week just unplugged with peers. I made some of my best friends at camp that week. I still am in touch with the people that I met during that week, and many of them came back with me to work on staff in later years at the program. So it hasn't changed all that much, which is really nice, because people who attended way back when can come send their kids to camp or their grandkids to camp and see that they're going to get very similar experiences to the ones that they knew and loved so much.
Hannah, you've made a particular point to make sure girls know that this is an excellent opportunity for them. Why is that?
Well, it seems every year we fill up our boys' week fairly easily. You know, we're always looking for more campers. We're always looking for more boys to join. But every year we seem to find this unique challenge of getting girls involved. You know, I have lots of theories as to why that could be. I don't know that anything for sure, but we are typically always searching for more girl campers. They tend to fill up. They just fill up later in the season. And as, you know, as a girl who got to experience this camp, I really want to make sure that the other girls who may have been now in similar places that I was in when I was their age get this opportunity, because it really affected me and changed my life, which, you know, sounds cheesy, but it is true. So this year is no exception. We have filled most of our boys' weeks at this point, and we have not filled our girls' weeks. So we're looking for both basic and advanced campers who want to come back and be a part of our program.
Well, it's not cheesy at all. I'm glad you bring this up, because you attended. So tell girls right now, tell them what you learned or what you really enjoyed about, you know, those weeks at camp that you had.
Absolutely. I think, especially as a 12 to 14 to 16-year-old girl, there are a lot of social pressures in school. There's a lot of trying to figure out who you are while also trying to, you know, blend in and maintain the status quo. And that was definitely true for me when I was that age. going to camp was the first time where I really got to sort of step out into my own light. I have two sisters, so I was always in the shadow of my older sister. I was always trying to fit in with the other girls in my class. And at camp, I sort of stepped away from that social structure, and was able to just be myself. I really got into the activities. It was super cool. So it was the first time ever to be, like, a nerdy nature girl, which I had, you know, something I identify with and have carried on through my life. So it was, you know, everyone was cheering each other on, supporting each other, and really doing their best effort to make camp a wonderful place, from the instructors to the junior counselors who are high school volunteers to the other campers. Just being able to find your own place and not have to worry about what everyone else thinks and just be your whole self, that was something that was really unique for me at the time and just a wonderful experience and made me want to keep coming back. And then on top of that, I got all of the amazing outdoor education that the camps offer. So it's pretty cool.
Yeah. Where'd you grow up, Hannah?
I grew up in a little town in southern Vermont called Sandgate.
Mm-hmm.
So it's by Arlington, Rupert area.
I know. It's not easy to get to either.
No.
So, Hannah, what do you hope kids will learn when they attend the conservation camps?
You know, I hope that they walk away with a greater appreciation for the outdoors. I hope that they learn about the effective management practices through, you know, hunting and fishing. But really, I just want them to make a meaningful connection with nature, to encourage them to continue exploring outside, to, you know, develop a care for the natural world in whatever aspect. If it's they really love animals, or they really love trees, or they got to have a mud fight during our aquatic ecology class, and that was awesome, you know, whatever it is, find something about nature that calls to them and really let them explore on that, both at camp and after.
I'm signing up for the mud fight is what I'm going to do. All right.
My favorite part.
Yeah. Let's try to get a quick call in here. We've got Wade calling. Hey, Wade, go right ahead.
Hey, good morning. Good morning, Rick. Good morning, Hannah.
Good morning.
Just wanted to send out a kudos to the way you're running these camps and true to the activities that relate to our beautiful state and the summers and the way it goes. I provide services for some other types of camps on the other end of the spectrum, which are a lot of students campers from around the country, a lot of internationals, and a lot of these are unattainable for Vermont kids to go to because they're, you know, 7,000 for 5 weeks, 4 or 5 weeks, 11,000 for a 7 or 8 week program. And then your specials are on top of that. So kudos to you for keeping that going and a little more true to what's going on as opposed to the country club camp.
Well, Wade, we really appreciate that call. And let's talk about some of the things Wade is talking about. First of all, let's talk about how and when parents can enroll their children, Hannah, for the camps this summer.
Absolutely. We have an open enrollment, so it's going on right now. I believe it opened in December. Any time between now and June that they want to sign their kids up, they can. But the earlier the better, because our spots are only open until they are filled up. So you can enroll by going to our website at vtfishandwildlife.com. There's a page specifically for GNCC, and it'll walk you through the whole application process.
All right. And as Wade mentioned, cost can be a factor, and sometimes that prohibits kids who really would flourish at one of these camps. So I understand that you have scholarships and sponsorships that are available.
Absolutely. So first off, the base price of camp to cover the cost of food, to help with staffing, that is $250 for the week. So we try to keep our tuition prices reasonable. If you aren't looking for a sponsorship or a scholarship, it's $250 for the week. That being said, we have two different options. So we are funded by the Vermont legislature to give scholarships to students and campers of low-income families. So we have a specific income requirement that if families meet that income requirement, they are eligible for a scholarship and can attend GNCC for free. On the other side of that is if maybe you don't qualify for the income requirements there, or you want to go a different route. We have tons of sponsors across the state who are willing to pay either all or part of the GNCC tuition. So I myself was sponsored as a camper. The Manchester Rod and Gun Club sponsored me and my sisters to go. So if you ask around to local Rod and Gun Clubs, Sportsman Clubs, the Bear Hound Association, any outdoor programs that are in your local area, ask them. They might have money that they're looking to give for a camper to go to camp. So, and our registrar can also help connect you with a sponsor if families are in need.
Oh, that's beautiful. How's the camp food?
So, honestly, we give campers this whole wonderful environmental education experience. We, like, teach them so many things, and then they fill out an eval at the end of the week. And it's like, what was your favorite part? And almost exclusively, campers write the food. So, it's delicious. We're catered by a Vermont company, and they provide all kinds of delicious, healthy, and desserts and all kinds of stuff that campers can't get enough of, and neither can the staff.
Hannah, is there a camp song?
Not really. We have lots of sing-along or repeat-after-me songs that we sing there, but I don't know that we have one specifically for our camp. So.
Oh, you're lucky. That's a good question. I was going to make you sing it, but...
thank you.
We'll let you slide on that one. What about camp counselors? Are you looking for people there?
We still do have a few spots open, particularly when we're looking for counselors, we're particularly looking for men this year. So anyone interested in joining our male staff definitely can send their application to me. But we have most of our spots filled. That's another position that we accept applications until they're full. So we have our admin team set for the summer. We're really excited to jump in with that. But we are still looking for a few instructors if anyone's interested.
And what are those requirements that someone would need to be able to be an instructor there?
Yeah, so we ask that all of our instructors have 1 year of college. Ideally, that would be in a natural resources field. However, we teach anything that instructors need to know at our orientation at the beginning of the summer. So they can come in with no real background, and as long as they are open and willing to learn, we can teach them everything they need to know for the summer. So, you know, we're just looking for people who have 1 year of college and then are willing to learn about hunting and firearms handling and natural resource management and all that kind of stuff, and willing to teach it to our campers.
Now, I went to your website and watched the camp video, and I have to admit, watching that, and I was ready to enroll myself. just tell people a little bit about what they'll see in that camp video, and it really is worth going to see if you're thinking about this.
So that camp video was put together by a junior counselor in our program, so a high school volunteer. She was working she found a passion for videography, and she put together a video with the intention just to show her friends how much she loves camp. And we jumped on that opportunity because it's such a good video.
Yeah.
It'll highlight some of the activities at both locations. She shows both campuses and what they look like. You know, they're very different places, so it's cool to get a sense of what each looks like. You know, she shows us swimming and hiking and building fires and all kinds of stuff, the classic camp activities, and a few surprises in there too, because she's a junior counselor. They do work projects so that you can still see them painting and that sort of stuff. But it really gives a highlight overview of some of the activities that campers and families can expect to see at camp.
And so many smiles. Hannah Phelps is the Green Mountain Conservation Camps Coordinator. And to learn more about the summer camps, you can visit vtfishandwildlife.com. Hannah, it was great having you on the program this morning. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
All right, take care. That's our show for today. Vermont Viewpoint is produced by Shayla Connor Shapiro and directed by Danny McGivergan. Our email address, vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. You can send us ideas for topics or guests. We love getting them. And to listen to past episodes of Vermont Viewpoint, you can do that by downloading our podcast at wdevradio.com. I'm Rick Sengary. I'll meet you back here tomorrow, and we're going to hear from Matthew Hongoltz Hetling. He's the author of a new book called A Libertarian Walks Into a Bear.